Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. 25 years ago, much of America watched on live TV a standoff between federal agents and a religious community in Waco, Texas. It lasted 51 days. It ended with tanks, tear gas, and flames. Members of the religious community, scores of them, men, women, and children, dead. Now, a new TV miniseries from Paramount tells the story of religious fanaticism, guns, and a botched federal assault. This hour on Point, Waco on the small screen, and its message 25 years on. You can join us on air or online. Do you remember what happened at Waco? Are you watching the new series? What do you think? What are the lessons? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from NPR West in Culver City, California, are the co-creators of the new six-part series, Waco. Drew Dowdle, he co-created, co-wrote three of the episodes of Waco. And Drew, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Good to be here.
And Drew's brother, John Eric Dowdle, also co-created, co-wrote three episodes and directed four episodes of Waco. John Dowdle, welcome to you. Great to have you as well.
Thanks, Anthony. It's nice to be here.
So I've got a bunch of questions for you guys. I'm not seeing you face to face, so just your brothers, you know how to deal with this. But I'm just going to ask questions and leave it to you who's going to answer. But tell us why you wanted to tell this story 25 years later for TV.
You know, we kind of, John and I like to say that the story kind of found us in a way. It's an event that we remember very clearly from back in the day in 1993. I was a senior in high school and John was a sophomore in college, so we were old enough to remember the events very well. And we always thought that there was just a lot more to that story than the media, you know, told us at the time. And there's a lot that came out in the congressional hearings after the fact that were really interesting and upsetting. And as far as making it into a show, it was not something we intended to do really until we were working on something completely different. And John actually stumbled onto David Thibodeau's book looking for a firsthand account of surviving a cult. And we kind of were going down a path of, you know.
And let me just jump in there. David Thibodeau is a surviving member of the Branch Davidians, one of the few surviving members, right, from the Branch Davidians.
That's correct. He was one of nine survivors of the fire. And it was interesting. Like, you know, we were looking to find something on, you know, what a crazy cult looks like. And we found his book. And he was, you know, living in Hollywood at 23, met David Koresh at the Guitar Center on Sunset Boulevard and ended up joining David Koresh's band, moved to Mount Carmel, and was one of the nine survivors of the fire. Mm-hmm. And there was just something in having faces and – or not faces, but having names and personalities to the people inside Mount Carmel totally transformed the experience of what I had seen on the news. You know, the news of the day was like tanks versus a house and or tanks versus a compound. But it wasn't you didn't get a sense of who the people on either side of that were. And there was just something in the kind of Kafkaesque nightmare of being – In a place where you have no communication with the outside world, and seeing on the news, you know, your community being, you know, slowly, you know, further and further demonized, and being able to do nothing about it. And
yeah.
After reading that book, Drew and I really, you know, said, like, let's do this, you know.
Well, John and Drew, I want to say, first of all, congratulations. I've seen the first three episodes. It's powerful stuff. And
I think
I think, among other things, Taylor Kitsch's performance as David Koresh is really something to highlight. So I want to give listeners just a little bit of a sense of what this show at least sounds like. So here's Taylor Kitsch, who plays David Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidians religious sect. He preaches about the joy of living in their isolated community without running water, without a lot of comforts in Mount Carmel, just outside of Waco, Texas.
So how is it A man can find joy here. Joy doesn't come from having something or being something. It comes from becoming. Becoming more than you are today.
That's actor Taylor Kitsch, who plays David Koresh in the new TV miniseries Waco from Paramount. And one more scene from that. So in the show, here's the scene of the first day of the ATF raid. That's the raid by officers from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The agents roll in with their tactical gear. They carry weapons. The Branch Davidians know they're coming. They're also armed. And David Koresh, played by Taylor Kitsch, comes out of the compound with his hands up to try to negotiate.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! Calm down! Please stop!
Keep your hands in the air and get on the ground
now! There are women and children in here!
Get on the ground now!
Let's go!
Shots fired. Everyone is shooting. Koresh is wounded. ATF agents are wounded. To this day, it's unclear who fired that first shot. John and Eric Dowdle, co-creators of Waco, are with me from California. That's a chilling scene, Brothers Dowdle. And I want to just read back one thing that you guys wrote in some of the publicity material. What transcribed over those 51 days remains one of the most misunderstood stories in American history. Big statement there. What are some of the chief things that were misunderstood?
Well, I think, you know, one of the chief things is the idea of David Koresh and the Branch Davidians being this like evil, monstrous, child torturing community. Like they were there was problems there for sure, but it wasn't exactly how they were portrayed. You know, they were portrayed in a much darker, much more demonized light than the people who were there experienced it.
Yeah, I think we spent so much time listening to all the negotiation tapes, too, and there's just thousands of hours of that. And, you know, we were definitely led to believe that David Koresh was the ultimate boogeyman, and he was, you know, not someone who was able to be reasoned with in any way. And then you listen to all these tapes, and it's very interesting how much of a rapport David actually had with the FBI negotiators and how much the Branch Davidians and the FBI negotiators were able to see one another's points of view and try to work it out peacefully, and I really believe they would have. And, you know, the other half of the story, the FBI and what they were going through was really just incredibly interesting to us, too, because the negotiators on the tactical side just did not see eye to eye on how to resolve this. And every time the negotiators would score a win, tactical would undercut that win and cause this deep level of distrust. So a real surprise to us is just how reasonable both sides were when it was the people that were actually communicating with each other.
It's really interesting, and I want to talk about that division between the negotiating guys and the tactical guys, but let me stick with David Koresh for a moment, because what Taylor Kitsch does a really good job in this show is portraying Koresh believably as a character who could attract a group of followers to his version of the truth, but not necessarily in a kind of completely wacky way. I mean, he's got some sense of, at least as Taylor Kitsch portrays him, a real sense of magnetism. And I'm assuming that that was drawn from what you understood David Koresh to be.
Absolutely. At this point, we've, you know, interviewed many of the survivors and you know, many of the people who had defected from the group. And we had a, you know, what emerged was a really surprising portrait. Like there's moments where he was funny and he, you know, played guitar in a, you know, and sang in a local bar. And, you know, there was all these kinds of things that for us was really, really surprising that, you know, I think it's sometimes easier to paint someone as a monster versus to try to look at, you know, the elements of you know, their environment and their upbringing that kind of made them what they are. And for us, we really like the idea that, you know, David Koresh does some pretty horrible things, but because he does it with charm, it almost doesn't seem like they're as horrible as they are. And we thought that was a really interesting way, yeah. You know, which apparently, you know, with the people who were there was what they experienced.
Yeah,
yeah, you've seen the first three episodes. I'd say later in the series, too, you really see a darker side of David emerge. And one of the intentions we had in how to structure the show was to, you know, take that preconception of who David Koresh was early in the series and kind of flip that on its head because it is so off base. But then you do see some of these darker elements of David come through because he was, you know, definitely guilty of some indefensible things. But, you know, a big part of our show and what we want to explore is just because someone is guilty of something, do the ends justify the means? You look at the operational side of this and the mistakes that were made and just the whole, you know, inception of the plan to begin with and what the motivations of that were and you know, the things they did in the name of protecting children that actually put the children in far more risk.
Yeah, let me play one more piece of tape. I mean, speaking of the allegations and some of the stuff that David Koresh did, I mean, all of the Branch Davidian men, except David Koresh, are supposed to be celibate. The women all serve as David Koresh's wives, including the teenage sister of Koresh's legal wife. So here's a scene from the show Waco. Michelle, played by Julia Garner, is beginning to have doubts about the arrangement of being one of David Koresh's wives.
When David had his vision that he should take me as his second wife, and nobody knew what to do about it. And just like that, I became his second wife. And just like that, I had serenity. And I mean, what about my dream? Who cared anything about my dreams?
Hasn't David been good to you?
That's not the point.
Scene from Waco. We're talking to Drew Dowdle and John Eric Dowdle. They're co-creators of the TV show Waco. Gentlemen, give me a sense of what you want listeners to take away from this show.
We want listeners to take away the idea that this was a lot more complicated. This scenario and what happened at Waco was a lot more, you know, in a gray zone. You know, it wasn't black and white. It wasn't this side was right and this side was wrong. Both sides had a lot of gray. Mm. And
well, when we come back, I want to pick up the other side, that is the law enforcement side, and what went so terribly wrong on that side. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking with the co-creators of the new miniseries Waco from Paramount, from the Paramount Network, that tells the story of Waco, Texas, and the standoff between the Branch Davidians and federal law enforcement that ended in a ball of fire, more than 70 dead. This occurred 25 years ago. You can join the conversation. How do you look at what happened in Waco 25 years ago? What does it say about the militarization of law enforcement? Where do you put the blame? My guests are Drew and John Eric Dowdle, co-creators of the six-part series Waco. And here's a scene from the show. Michael Shannon plays FBI negotiator Gary Nessner, who tries to convince his boss to spend more resources on training agents to negotiate instead of using force.
There's a paradox to power. The more force you bring to a situation, the more likely you are to meet resistance. If we could spend some of those resources training agents to negotiate, I guarantee that you would invest a lot less in body bags.
We can't talk our way out of every situation. Show of force helps bring people to the negotiating table.
So, Drew and John, talk a little bit about sort of what you learned about what went wrong at Waco, and specifically this argument within the federal law enforcement community about whether it was to use force or to be better at negotiating.
Well, I think at that moment in America, the FBI decided, like, just in case there was a big problems with citizenry, like, let's invest a lot of money in a kind of super SWAT force. And so the FBI created the hostage rescue team. And this was like the, you know, this like super SWAT, you know, force that had a lot of money and a lot of equipment. And what you see immediately after that is, you know, situations like Ruby Ridge or Waco, where they have all this equipment and it's sitting there, and it creates an extra pressure to start militarizing and using greater force, as opposed to, you know, coming into a situation and just trying, you know, trying time and communication.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's twofold, too. You have to look at Waco, I think, on the part of the ATF and the FBI. And I'm really glad you played that one clip, because we became really big believers in Gary Nesner's philosophy of the paradox of power, and how, you know, the more force you bring to a situation, the more likely you are to be met with resistance. And I think you see that on February 28th when the ATF first showed up. You know, this is kind of the first element of getting off course from what the mission really was to inspect the guns in there. And they showed up with, you know, a force that, unlike anything the ATF had ever put together before, you know, kind of a full military assault, despite the fact they had only had a knock-and-serve search warrant, and they had a plan to raid the building with the children in it. And that, you know, there's so much discussion over who shot first and how did it ignite, and we look at it as this was just the situation dying to go wrong, and severely wrong. And so the ATF's initial operation, we think, was, you know, their initial investigation had merit, but then the way they executed the plan had ulterior motives, and those ulterior motives ultimately really set this whole thing in motion. And then the FBI inherits the situation, you know, after the shootout, and they're in a very tricky spot. But reading Gary Nesner's book, it's amazing just how there was an immediate wedge between the negotiators and tactical, and it just got deeper and deeper with every passing day. Mm. And that growing tension is a really big part of the series.
And I want to talk to you more about Gary Nesner, the lead negotiator for the FBI, and how he was involved in the production of this show in a moment. But I want to get some callers in. We've got a lot of them backed up. Let's go to Rodney, who's calling from Marshall, North Carolina. Rodney, great to have you on the air.
Hi, Anthony. If I'm not mistaken, I do believe that there was an ATF agent that was killed during the raid. I went to college with a guy, ETSU, East Tennessee State University, and he was a criminal justice major there. And if I'm not mistaken, you know, he was killed in the raid, but there was some speculation that he may have been killed by friendly fire. There were a lot of, like, these black helicopter conspiracy theory videos running around, you know, floating around shortly afterwards, and they showed footage of this guy going up a ladder, shooting himself in the leg, and then continuing up and kind of spastically shooting into a room full of other agents and getting shot.
Rodney, I'm glad you put the issue of government casualties on the table. Four ATF agents were killed in the raid. Is that right, Drew and John?
That's correct.
That is correct.
Yeah. And
six Branch Davidians.
And so, how many Branch Davidians?
Six.
Six, right, okay. In the initial raid, I mean, obviously many more Branch Davidians were killed in the fire. Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Eric, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hey, Anthony. A couple points I'll try to make as brief as possible. First of all, this is a good warning on a kind of a microcosm level of what's going on in the national stage with respect to force versus diplomacy. And, you know, if your only tool is a hammer, everything is a nail. And, you know, look how it turned out in Waco. So that can inform some of, you know, the national conversation. The other quick point I wanted to make is I understand that the cult leader was demonized a lot, but let's be careful not to swing into the apologist territory. I mean, the man was a pedophile. He did have sex with underage women, children, you know.
Eric, okay, I appreciate the point. Go ahead, Drew
and
John.
I think that's a very solid point. I think that's something we were trying very hard not to do, is to, you know, by changing the impression of David Koresh a little bit, you automatically sympathize with him more. But he was guilty of you know, pretty terrible things, and we don't shy away from that either. I think, you know, one of the decisions we made early is let's try to see David Koresh as David Thibodeau saw him, you know, as someone who was a new member of the group, where a lot of those things were not, you know, out front and center, and it's not something that they, you know, saw directly. It wasn't, you know, a rampant child abuse factory kind of situation. It wasn't like that, but we certainly don't want to shy away from the things David was guilty of, but we... You know,
no,
we
and
do
I
want
take,
to make the point.
Yeah, I
of,
take
you know,
I take your point, yeah. And it's important because one of the things that I think you do successfully in this show is to make the you explain how it is that so many people could be attracted to someone like David Koresh. And to do that, you sort of need to present him at least initially as a sort of an appealing character. And this gets to a whole another part of the conversation that I wanted to ask you about, and that is who were the Branch Davidians? I mean, who were these people who were attracted to David Koresh?
I mean, they came from all walks of life, you know, but one of the things that surprised us most getting into this was how educated so many of them were. There was, you know, Harvard law graduates and professors of theology and, you know, like really people who really knew their stuff. And, you know, we sort of expected it to be, you know, uneducated, you know, the kind of people who follow something, you know, without much thought. And what we did not find that here. You know, there was a lot of really good people in that community. And it's interesting, you know, there's people like Steve Schneider, who is David Koresh's second in command. Both sides of this thing, you know, everyone, all the Branch Davidians loved Steve Schneider, and all the FBI negotiators loved Steve Schneider. Like, he was, you know, the negotiators have said if David had died and Steve, you know, was the one remaining, everyone would have come out of there safely.
Hmm.
So it's interesting, you know, they were all sort of painted with one brush. It's interesting once there is separation, you realize there was dissent, there was people who felt great pain, you know, based on David's revelations and, you know, his dictates.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, whatever you think about David Koresh, even if you believe he is the ultimate monster, which some people do, it still doesn't justify the way the rest of them were treated. And I think when the place burned down at the end, everyone said, oh, well, they got what they had coming to them. And, you know, they were thumbing their nose at the FBI and they could have come out at any time. So they chose to die. And we tried our best to stop it, but it wasn't good enough. And I don't know, the lives of the rest of them inside was kind of minimized by the fact that they were, quote unquote, a cult. As soon as you call a group of people a cult, the value of their lives seems to diminish dramatically.
I know I've got to let you guys go in about a minute, but I'm just fascinated by one detail that I want to ask you about before I let you go, and that is getting survivor David Thibodeau together with former FBI negotiator Gary Noesner. They were both involved in the series. They got together. They talked. What was that like to have these guys together?
Honestly, it was pretty magical. You know, seeing them, like, you know, at first we were worried, you know, frankly, about how it would go because they're both pretty outspoken. And, you know, a couple days into the shoot, we'd see them. They'd be sitting at lunch together, just the two of them, like hashing things out and sort of, you know, going, you know, getting into the weeds with each other. And at this point, they're like, I wouldn't say they're friends, but they're
friendly, though.
They're friendly.
And it's amazing. It's kind of hits to the theme of our show, too. It's that when people are actually communicating with one another, how quickly they can put their differences aside and find common ground. It's when you're one level deeper where you're not the one communicating that things tend to fall apart.
Well, Drew and John Eric Dowdle, co-creators of the new 6-part series Waco from the Paramount Network, thanks so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Congratulations on the show.
Thank you so much.
Very powerful, I got to say.
Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure having you. And let me turn now to Tyler, Texas, Lee Hancock. She's a former reporter for the Dallas Morning News, where she covered the Waco siege and the Oklahoma City bombing. She's currently working on a book on Waco and its aftermath. And Lee Hancock, welcome to On Point. It's very good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'd love to just get your initial take on what you've seen so far. I assume you've seen at least the first two or three episodes. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's an interesting piece of drama, but in terms of reflecting the facts of what happened down there, you know, it's troubling. There is there are a lot of issues that they just misrepresent about what happened, about, you know, the ATF and in some cases the FBI, about Ruby Ridge. And, you know, I know that in a drama series that you have to elide, you have to compress, you have to, you know, make composite figures, but there's some things that are happening in this that frankly trouble me in the same way.
Well, tell me, give me an example what you're most concerned about, Lee.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the ATF made pretty terrible mistakes, and I think that their agents admit that they made mistakes throughout this. But this was not a raid that was planned as a publicity stunt. That certainly is something that some people have accused them of. But, you know, there was a Treasury review that went into great depth in looking at what happened. There was also the Danforth report. And neither of those investigations, which were very thorough, came to any kind of conclusion like that. This wasn't a publicity stunt. These guys were brought in actually by the sheriff of McLennan County because the sheriff was worried about some of the things that were coming to Mount Carmel by UPS. There was a report of grenade holes at first, and the ATF was actually invited in because the sheriff's department thought they couldn't handle this. So there's also the portrayal that somehow they're friends with the sheriff's department. You know, the Davidians certainly say that, but I've heard very, very different things from the sheriff's department. There are, you know, questions about illegal guns, and, you know, in the first three episodes I've seen, there's a portrayal that Koresh was saying, oh, I'm being very careful about my guns, and I'm not doing anything illegal, and he even tells the undercover agent, don't bring illegal weapons around here. But the fact is that there were people in the group who, after the siege, said, absolutely, we were converting legal assault rifles to illegal machine guns. There was one guy in particular that brought the heavy equipment needed to do it all the way from California and talked about Koresh teaching him with a video how to do this.
I see.
They found 48 illegal weapons. They found grenades. And there's also a really serious question about who fired first. There were three reporters actually out there that day, three journalists. There were more than that, but none of the journalists were brought by ATF. In fact, ATF did not know they were going to come, and that's a very complicated issue too. But the three of the journalists who were there said the shooting started before the agents were out of the trailers. And their initial account was that they believed that the first gunshots came from inside. Now, there's a lot of different accounts of what happened. I mean, this was basically a war zone, so it was very confusing very fast. But
Lee Hancock, let me just jump in. I want to just bring you back to that
sort
of first thing that a lot of us saw 25 years ago. I mean, I remember watching this live on CNN for literally weeks and then seeing that awful fire. You were down there covering it. What was it like? What was your impression? I mean, did you realize what a sort of ungodly, unprecedented event this was?
Absolutely, very quickly. I mean, there had been never anything like it. I mean, you know, there had never been this kind of shootout in American law enforcement history, not just for ATF, but for anybody. You know, one of the issues that I think is it's hard to understand in retrospect is that, you know, the SWAT costumes, the equipment that they went in with were all what cops were using and still use to intimidate. The hope is that they're going to look so overwhelming that people just roll over. And in this case, the Davidians had 45 minutes after they found out, they were tipped off that the ATF was coming. And, you know, they could have given up.
Mm-hmm.
They chose not to. They chose instead to ambush. And, you know, on the ATF side, the ATF knew that the Davidians had been tipped off. The undercover agent really did an amazingly heroic job of trying to tell his supervisors, they know we're coming. NATF decided to go anyway. So,
and that was the role played by the actor John Leguizamo, who really tries to warn off the federal agents who are about to do the assault. So that was based on something pretty accurate. Listeners, were
not exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead. Correct the record then.
He didn't stand in the middle of the road and wave at a convoy, and there wasn't a convoy, and the helicopter didn't come flying in like that, and the helicopter didn't shoot at the compound. Davidians later came out and began to say, after Koresh began to say, you were shooting at us from the helicopters, Davidians also began to say, you were shooting at us from the helicopters as they came out. Some Davidians...
Lee Hancock, I'm going to jump in because we're up against the clock, but we're going to continue this conversation. Listeners, we're talking about Waco, the standoff between the federal government and the Branch Davidians that ended in an inferno that killed more than 70 men, women, and children, and how it lingers with us. There's a new TV series based on that. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking this hour about Waco 25 years later. You can join the conversation. What's the connection between what happened in Waco and what's going on today with gun rights and anti-government groups and militias? Lee Hancock is with me from Tyler, Texas. She's a former reporter for the Dallas Morning News, where she covered the siege in Waco. We've also been talking about a new TV show, a miniseries called Waco. Here is some tape. Some real tape from February 28, 1993. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms attempted to raid the compound owned by the religious group, the Branch Davidians. Here was the report from Walter Rogers on ABC's World News Tonight.
The federal agents came under heavy and sustained fire as they approached a ranch owned by Texas religious cult leader Vernon Howell, also known as David Koresh.
Lee Hancock, a lot of the conversation with the creators of the program, Drew and John Dowdle, focused on this this division within the FBI between folks and the ATF, between folks who wanted to sort of go more aggressively and folks who favored negotiation. I'm wondering how you covered that issue and sort of how that ended up informing how federal law enforcers think about this kind of challenge.
Well, at the time, you know, the FBI was not talking a lot about that division, but it was extreme. And it became known in the aftermath of the raid. And we could see the signs of it, where you would see where they started, they cut the power to the compound, not as early as portrayed in the movie, but they cut it in fairly quickly, and this was something that happened after the negotiators had actually gotten some people out. And, you know, you could see where they would start blasting noise. I mean, one of the more bizarre moments, and this was a subject of a piece on CNN, at 3 o'clock in the morning, they start blasting Tibetan monk chants, and they only quit doing that when the Dalai Lama literally wrote the Attorney General and said, you know, this is insulting to my religion and all Buddhists. And so, I mean, there was this craziness about what was happening. Now, we couldn't get to the bottom of what it was until later, but it was very, very clear, if you look at the FBI's own internal discussions, that there was this division, and it was extreme. And, you know, the one thing that I will say is that, you know, Gary Noesner is a remarkable gentleman who was leading a group of folks who were really trying their best to try to get these people out. And what is also remarkable is at the end of the day, the head of the hostage rescue team who, you know, pushed for these aggressive tactics actually said in a confidential interview to the Department of Justice that if we'd been given enough time, we would have gotten more out. But how much is more time? I think the FBI lost patience and they lost face and they were concerned about their public image. But then you had guys like Noesner and a whole team of negotiators who were doing, you know, heroic work to try to relate to the Davidians, to try to get them to think about coming out, and then to, you know, they got a large number of them out before they stopped.
Lee Hancock, stand by, because I want to introduce another person to this conversation. From Atlanta, Ryan Lenz. He's senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report. He's editor of its Hate Watch blog. And Ryan Lenz, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you, what do you remember personally about the standoff at Waco? What strikes you 25 years later?
Well, I was a senior in high school at the time, and I recall, you know, 18 years old, becoming aware of the world around me and seeing those very horrific video images of the balls of flames just licking from the sides of this building. It's only in the years since that I've come to understand what it meant, what it stood for, and certainly what it's inspired.
Well, so let me ask you that. 25 years later, what does it mean? What is the significance? What are the important messages and lessons of Waco that we should keep present?
Well, I think it's important to look in the immediate aftermath of what Waco brought to the world. You know, 2 years later, to the day, Timothy McVeigh bombs the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City because of what happened in Waco. And he had visited the site after the raids and was incredibly angered by what he saw. And those two events, coupled with Ruby Ridge, continue to be inspiring factors for, you know, the militia movement and the anti-government movement today.
You know, we've got some interesting tape from this issue around Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber. He talked about several events causing him to snap. He mentioned Ruby Ridge, as you mentioned, Ryan. That's when federal agents killed the wife and young child of a white supremacist, Randy Weaver, during a standoff in Idaho. And he talked about the events of Waco, how it solidified his hostility toward the U.S. government. He described his reaction to Waco in a 2000 interview with CBS's 60 Minutes.
Shaken, disillusioned, angered, that could happen in this country where our core beliefs are freedom and liberty. And what did you do to these people? You deprived them of life, liberty, and property. You didn't guarantee those rights. You deprived them of them.
So, Ryan Lenz, you suggest that, essentially talk about how widespread that effect was, I guess.
Well, the anti-government movement, the patriot movement, the militia movement in this country, what they fear most is what they call the New World Order, which is the federal government, the U.S. government being in cahoots with some global cabal of interests who hope to deprive American citizens of their liberties as guaranteed by the Constitution and ultimately their sovereignty as Americans. So Ruby Ridge, Waco, these events were visual displays of power that many in the anti-government movement felt was proof positive that the federal government was arming up to bring about this new system of governance, this one world government. It was incredibly terrifying for a lot of people who had gone head first into this rabbit hole of curiosity, and it was also inspiring at a time when. When gun shows were peddling conspiracy theories across the country and these militias were popping up to combat what they had seen on the screen.
You know, it's interesting, too, because it occurs to me that this was taking place during the Clinton administration, which pushed the Brady Bill.
Correct.
An assault weapons ban, if I'm remembering correctly.
Correct.
All these things become a rallying cry for the anti-government movement, right?
It's this perfect storm of events, policies, and procedures that ultimately from a certain perspective, gave the impression that not only was the federal government a terror and a tyrannical terror at that, but they were working actively to deprive Americans of their constitutional rights, constitutional rights that were enshrined to protect protect the country from falling into. The tyranny that they saw on the screen.
Listeners, we're talking about Waco 25 years later, the tragic and deadly confrontation between government officers, government essentially FBI and ATF agents, and the Branch Davidians, a religious cult. Let's go to Gowon, who's calling from South Korea. Gowon, it's good to have you.
Oh, Anthony, hi, and I'm very good to join you guys, but I just want to mention a couple of things really quickly. The thing is, how you guys see, any common aspect that might be shared from case with David Krush and other homegrown terrorists who can actually play as a religious cult or a guru who can easily radicalize the people living in the United States, you know, for would-be future terrorists in the United States. And what do you think about the aspect of WACO, how that might actually turn or change to counterterrorism or whatsoever terror, counter-terror measures taken by your law authority in a serious sense? You know, how does that actually shape it in actual meaning?
Go on. Thanks. I appreciate the call. I'd like to get both Lee and Ryan to respond to that. Let me start with you, Ryan. I mean, I think the question there, you know, how do religious stereotypes sort of lead to the kind of, fomenting of homegrown terrorism?
Well, I think that's, you know, that's a very complicated question and an even more complicated answer. And especially if you start to look at it from a domestic terrorism perspective. Well, I mean, this all happened in the early 90s. And, you know, we've since moved into, you know, we're in a post 9/11 world where terrorism is a definitively different thing, or at least it exists in the minds of most Americans now. I think what's interesting about let's draw a direct parallel between what some recent events to what we saw in the early 90s. Take, for example, Cliven Bundy, the Nevada cattle rancher, who had that standoff in 2014 with the federal government. He was recently his trial ended with a mistrial after it was determined the federal government had hidden evidence from defense attorneys regarding the actual actions of tactical agents in the Bureau of Land Management. So I think what we're talking about is, and there was a very serious religious component to that as well, to what the Bundys were doing in Nevada. Mm. I think it's sometimes important to separate the idea of a religious cult or a religious extremist from terrorism, so as to make it a simpler arithmetic.
Got it. Good question. Good answer. Let's go to Rob, who's calling from Tenet Assassin, Florida. Rob, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I wanted to say really quickly that watching that unfold in a Fern Bar, you know, I think it brought home, not only to the people I was watching it with, to many, many middle-class Americans, that the police are no longer, whether federal or local, Andy Griffith, or as it's portrayed in Adam 12, you know, the Blue Knights, the people in the diffused situations, but that they're there when they want to, not to serve and protect, but really to overwhelm and crush. And I think it was a real sea change. I think in the inner cities that perception had existed already, and it obviously still does, but I think for many middle-class Americans, it really completely altered their perception of what the police and law enforcement were about and what they were capable of.
Rob, it's a really interesting issue. Lee Hancock, I'd love you to respond to that. I mean, it seems like Rob is referring to the sort of militarization of police forces and how Waco might have been the first big event that really reminded us of that in a big way.
Well, I mean, one of the things you also have to look at is the guns and what kind of weaponry this group had and some other groups have amassed, you know, when you are going up against people who have hundreds of assault rifles and they have made them into machine guns, when you have, and they had indications that they were converting those or they would not have gone in. They had indications that there were grenades. You know, one of the questions is when you're the cops, how do you respond?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time all this was going on, there was also a debate among different law enforcement agencies. And that's when you began to see them shift to a different, from it like a revolver like you saw on old FBI shows to Glocks. And, you know, there is this sort of mutual, you know, there's this mutual arming up on both sides that I think you have to look at. I think that, you know, certainly some of the things that they brought to bear both in Waco and Ruby Ridge were alarming. And at Ruby Ridge, they also used armored vehicles. They also brought in tanks. Their original plan was to crush buildings, just like they ended up doing in Waco. It's very disturbing, but these are also really complex scenarios, complex events that are hard to tease apart.
Yeah.
You know, the police, you know, walking into that thing, were not expecting to be met with gunfire.
But I'm curious to ask this, and maybe, Ryan, you know the answer to this as well. To what extent, I guess, did the after-action reports or the investigation into what went so wrong at Waco, to what extent did they change the way federal law enforcement operates, or did they?
Well, I think they changed it considerably in a couple of ways. The primary way is the understanding of how kinetic action can be an escalating factor.
Explain that. What does that mean, kinetic action?
Okay, well, look at Ruby Ridge. It was an 11-day siege that ends just horribly, with tremendous mistakes being made from both perspectives, from the perspective of the Weaver family and certainly from the perspective of the federal government. But that siege, and then the the February 28th to April 19th standoff in Waco that ended so horribly, law enforcement started to understand just how to behave and how to conduct themselves to bring about a peaceful resolution with people who were heavily armed and animated by extremist ideas in the aftermath of these two events. Take, for example, the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge a couple of years ago. 41 days, the federal government really doesn't do anything. In fact, lets people come and go, go get groceries, provisions, and so on. It was a really strategic idea just to leave these people alone and let the cause sort of die out under their own under its own sort of weight. And so I think that law enforcement has learned a lot about how to approach extremists, especially when they take such a hard stance like what we saw in Ruby Ridge or Waco.
Yeah, go ahead, Lee.
And if I could throw in real quick, I mean, one of the dilemmas you have is that after Waco, certainly at the Republic of Texas standoff and
right.
the Montana militia, they did step back, they waited, they didn't show this military presence. And as a matter of fact, Gary Nestner was instrumental in both of those. The FBI decided to make its tactical arm, the hostage rescue team, and its negotiators equal. When in Waco, Nestner was actually a military rank beneath the head of the hostage rescue team. They changed that, and they began training their commanders who went in. ATF also made big changes. But one of the dilemmas is that then you have something like Columbine, which may not seem related, but in Columbine, when there was the school shooting, you had the problem of police officers who waited, who did not go in, who thought there was still an active shooter in the building. As a consequence, people there died, bled to death. The shooters were already dead. And so cops, police departments had to adjust their thinking and their training. Do we go in faster? And so these things present such a huge dilemma because what we've got, you can kill people so quickly. And it's a difficult thing for them to try to weigh in every one of these cases.
Got it. Boy, complicated events indeed. I'm still struck by FBI negotiator Gary Nestner's quote, "There is a paradox to power. The more force you bring to a situation, the more likely you are to meet resistance." Anyway, Lee Hancock, former reporter for the Dallas Morning News who covered Waco. Lee, thanks so much. Really appreciate having you today.
Thank you.
And Ryan Lynn, senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center, intelligence report, and editor of the Hate Watch blog. Ryan, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.